The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
Hello, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Today, we're talking about pediatric lung conditions with a particular focus on asthma, one of the most common chronic diseases of childhood, and how families can navigate care when breathing problems persist, from chronic cough and wheezing to lingering symptoms after viral infections, including COVID. It's not always clear what's normal, what's concerning, and when it's time to seek specialty care. Because children's lungs are still developing, getting the right diagnosis and the right level of care at the right time can make a meaningful difference, not just now, but for long-term lung health. Joining us today is Dr. Jared Weinstock, a board-certified pediatric pulmonologist with Providence, Alaska Medical Center. He's also the medical director of pediatric subspecialties for Providence Medical Group. Dr. Weinstock trained in pediatrics and pediatric pulmonology on the East Coast before moving to Alaska in 2021. And now he cares for children across our state with a wide range of lung and breathing conditions. Dr. Weinstock, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. Looking forward to the discussion.
I've been looking forward to this for quite some time, so I'm really grateful to you. Okay, Dr. Weinstock, I want you to start us off and tell us about your path into medicine and what initially drew you into pediatrics?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been a very interesting journey. It started, of course, you know, my undergraduate studies involved biochemistry. That was my major. And I was on the pre-med track. I always wanted to be a physician, always intrigued by anatomy, the human body, physiology, all of that. And for some reason, I always thought I was going to become a surgeon.
Really?
I don't know where that came from.
It's
I never
fun.
Really had or shadowed, you know, anybody in my family or anything of that nature. But, you know, still kept an open mind. Went to medical school, of course, you know, during my rotations, had really good mentorship in pediatrics. And I was in Miami, Florida at the time, doing that particular rotation, and it was my second rotation of medical school, I remember vividly. And again, you know, I was like, wow, this is, I really like this, you know. It was a husband and wife, they owned a booming practice in the South Florida area, and I really just took a huge liking to it. And then after that, you know, had internal medicine, surgery, and the rest of the other rotations, and it just came down to the fact that it felt right in terms of pediatrics. So that's where I ended up going into my pediatric residency, which was in New Jersey. And from there, again, kept an open mind, did not know that I was going to go into pediatric pulmonology. But again, the mentorship was key. And I tell that even to people that I've had follow me here in Alaska. I have some high school students that are in some gifted mentorship programs through the Anchorage School District. I think it's great to have these mentors that can guide you early on. So in my pediatric residency, again, a great pediatric pulmonologist that was in that practice and part of the group, and really just at the end of the day, just felt right. I loved the, of course, pathology, the physiology of the respiratory system. It's obviously critical, right, for us to be
Absolutely.
Breathing. And I like the fact that it was a nice mix of inpatient, outpatient, and also some procedures as well. So not just, you know, in a clinic setting all day or spending time all day long in an ICU. It's a nice mix. Every day is completely different. You never really know what to expect. So I think that's what really intrigued me, and that's what led me into my fellowship in DC at Children's National Hospital. And I completed my 3-year fellowship there and then came to Alaska right after that.
Here you are. Now, are there other physicians in your family?
No, I'm the first physician in my immediate and pretty much extended family as well. My dad was a pharmacist, but I'm the first physician.
Right. I find that with children or young adults that come from families that have physicians, they have so much more of an edge because they understand the system a little bit more,
right,
and they kind of get that mentorship early on. So it's really important for you to stand in as that mentor for other people who most people don't have that. They don't have physician families.
Yeah. No, I think it's critical, you know, to have that even early on when you're trying to make up your mind and decide, do I go on this path? I mean, you know, it's a really long journey and it could be very difficult at times. So you want to make sure you have your heart in it and not waste your time if it just does not feel right. So to have some of these, you know, younger people, including especially in high school, you know, that you're able to guide and or at least show them, you know, the field, I think that is just amazing to happen early on. Mm-hmm.
The field is so vast. The field of medicine is so vast, healthcare. And then even within our specialties in pediatrics, it's huge.
Absolutely. Right? I mean, even at Providence here, you know, we have pretty much all of the subspecialties, you know, the pediatric subspecialties, very similar to the adult setting. So it's critical, you know, especially in an area here where we're so remotely located, and without having at least one subspecialist in the field, in any of these subspecialties, you know, families and patients are needing to go down to the lower 48, you know, typically Seattle or some of the larger children's hospitals. And this is very time consuming and a huge burden when we don't have that kind of help here locally.
Right. So a child's body, it's not just like a little adult.
Yes.
So tell us about what pediatric pulmonology does.
Right. So it is a vast spectrum within pediatric pulmonology. So, of course, I treat people from the extremely premature age range. So, I mean, you know, nowadays we're able to see infants being born as early as sometimes 22 weeks. And again, I spend a decent amount of time in the NICU setting or even in my clinic in the outpatient following a lot of these children who were born premature and did not have the appropriate lung development, of course, because of their premature birth. So they present with a whole different type of presentation in terms of, you know, their clinical condition, the potential to go on to have something like asthma down the road just because of a lot of the airway inflammation and the underdeveloped lungs. And then aside from that, you know, going into the toddler years, of course, even for, of course, for kids born full term, you know, we have wheezing, we have coughing, we have sometimes early stages of asthma and some other conditions that may be even on the rarer side, of course. I see a lot of different genetic conditions, even some very rare ones that I've never even heard of, even from a textbook, you know, in medical school. Oh. So it's very, very interesting. And then again, you know, the school age teenagers, they, you know, a lot of times we see asthma presenting during those periods as well, but definitely see and treat a lot of other conditions like cystic fibrosis. We're an accredited affiliate center here in Alaska. Wow. Which is great. You know, other rarer conditions as well, like interstitial lung diseases, bronchiectasis, we see a decent amount of. So it's a very, very wide range. And again, the severity levels within those conditions are also very variable, right? I think a lot of times it depends on, you know, genetics, of course, environmental factors. A lot of these things, I think, contribute, you know, widely to, you know, how a patient presents in my clinic or even in the hospital when I first meet them.
Well, you've practiced medicine in multiple locations, so of all in the East, in the South, now in Alaska, are there conditions that you see here that are more common than they've been in these other places?
Well, I mean, of course, we know common things are common, and mm-hmm. asthma for sure is definitely one of those things I see pretty regularly here, at least on a daily basis for sure. I will say we know the asthma rates in Alaska are definitely much higher, especially in some of the outlying areas where we lack some of the services and the ability to treat, you know, pretty quickly or timely. Mm. So I think the severity of asthma is definitely much higher here. And I know even, unfortunately, associated morbidity and mortality is known to be much higher here in Alaska compared to other states. I would say even with bronchiectasis, which is a fancy word that just really describes chronic airway inflammation and just breakdown of some of these airways that over time we see here in Alaska, at least some of the more common things being environmental. So wood-burning stoves, for instance, recurrent pneumonias or recurrent infections that go untreated for long periods of time can lead to this. So we tend to see higher rates of that as well. And, you know, for years in the past, even the CDC here in Alaska, they were looking into a lot of this research behind why does this occur at such higher rates and is there any other trigger? And what we know is that a lot of times it is unfortunately environmental here in the state. And again, just that lack of appropriate care sometimes that delays, you know, their treatment and leads to these kinds of chronic conditions.
Very interesting, because when I think of Alaska, I think of our clean air. And so I would think that we'd have less of an environmental impact on our breathing. The wood-burning stoves is not something I thought about, but in recent years, you know, I've been hearing a lot about the gas stoves, mm-hmm. so we just can't cook.
Right. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So what about adult lung conditions, and how do they correlate with some of these conditions that we see in childhood? What are the most common things that we see in adults?
Yeah. Well, I think what we are really observing right now, and at least what I observe in my practice, because, you know, I know I see mainly the pediatric population, but again, the age range, like I mentioned, could be these very extremely premature infants, but I'm also seeing young adults and even some older adults as well with some conditions. Of course, I am a pediatric pulmonologist, but I think it comes with the territory here in Alaska, especially with our cystic fibrosis population. You know, I am the only, you know, full-time pulmonologist seeing these patients, both pediatric and adult. So what I can say is, to answer your question, is that I think a lot of these things start in the younger years, and they may just go undetected or untreated or undertreated. And I think what I'm seeing, at least what I'm observing, is that these conditions are leading into the adult years to irreversibility, meaning, yes, we can treat some of the symptoms, but, you know, unfortunately, you know, we can't fix the problem a lot of times, right, with some of the conditions. You know, I really do think what I'm seeing, for instance, like asthma, super common in the childhood years, but for those people that don't comply with treatment or adhere to what's recommended or never receive treatment, I see that turning into like a COPD type of a picture as an adult. And we know COPD is pretty common. We think of smokers, but I'm not necessarily seeing that, you know, here in Alaska all the time. I think the people I'm seeing with a COPD type of picture is related, unfortunately, to undertreated or, you know, asthma that was never diagnosed, you know, properly, for instance. So I think some of the lung conditions, again, we have to get a good past history, because I think a lot of that could be linked to how they're presenting later on.
That does sound pretty scary. Now, do you think that this undertreatment is mostly people who are living remote? Or is this what you're seeing here in Anchorage or in larger cities that have access but perhaps don't seek that care because, you know, a lot of times you're like, I think it's fine, it's just a cough, it's just, you know, they exerted themselves. Are you seeing that sort of delay of care as well?
Well, I think I'm seeing both, to be honest. The remoteness here in Alaska is definitely unique in that, yes, I think that's a huge part in terms of, you know, somebody can establish care and then maybe have delayed follow-up or be lost to follow-up just because of the distance and the amount of time it takes to travel or coordinate travel with the family. Mm-hmm. But yeah, also, I mean, if it's a milder presentation of something, you know, maybe I recommend treatment, but, you know, a couple months go by and, okay, well, we don't feel like we need the treatment anymore. Yes. But, you know, we're doing lung function testing in the office and we see that, I don't know if I agree with that. I think we do need to carry on with this treatment for a little bit longer. That's what I worry about and what I'm referring to earlier when I mentioned, you know, these conditions can lead to problems later on in life. So I do think compliance, of course, and understanding or having a greater awareness of these kinds of things is super critical when it comes to any kind of respiratory condition.
Well, when I hear the word pulmonologist, and I'm sure many families, when they hear pulmonologist, they're thinking severe or end-stage disease. Is this a misconception? Do you encounter this misconception, and how do you address it?
Absolutely. A pulmonologist is, again, a specialist who is treating any sort of respiratory or lung condition, any breathing problem. So, again, it could be a very, very mild condition or maybe very acute problem versus, again, a longer-term issue that we need to deal with. So, again, there is a wide, wide range. And, again, even the severity, too, could be mild to very severe. So I don't want people to think when they hear a pulmonologist, oh, no, my symptoms are not that bad. In fact, I think we can help the person, you know, decrease the progression of that disease and decrease the severity of their symptoms appropriately if we can arrive at a proper diagnosis.
Right. Well, how do you see yourself what is your role on a child's care team?
Well, you know, again, most of the referrals are coming from the primary care setting. So, you know, I think I see myself, depending on the condition, as, you know, one of these, you know, primary people that are helping to address whatever issue may be going on. I sometimes see some of the people more so than the primary care providers. Mm-hmm. So I think it, again, depends on the underlying problem. But we sometimes have patients that get confused. Sometimes, you know, they look at us as the go-to, you know, because a lot of their problems are respiratory predominant. But again, I see myself as playing a very important role with most of the people regarding their breathing.
Can you tell us about some of the symptoms or maybe red flags where you should consider a progression of care, or you need to go to your primary first if you have these symptoms?
Sure. So I think in general, what would concern me is when there is a change from somebody's baseline that is happening on a frequent basis. So for instance, we know a chronic cough or wheezing, things of that nature, these are not normal symptoms. Mm-hmm. So when we are having these occur persistently and, you know, multiple times throughout any given year, for instance, this should be a red flag. This should be a reason to initiate a referral to a specialist, potentially like myself, to further evaluate. Sometimes it could be just a one-time visit just to ensure we're not missing anything, or to arrive at the diagnosis and start treatment. And then again, usually the primary care provider can sometimes continue this if they feel confident with it. So I think anything above your baseline is super important to bring up to, you know, your primary care provider, for instance. And certainly what would concern me from a respiratory standpoint, any kind of hospitalization, frequent emergency department visits, the need for systemic steroids, frequent antibiotics for infections, you know, once in a blue moon, these things can happen, of course, and it could just be an unfortunate instance. But when they are happening at higher frequency, that is super concerning. Something needs to be looked into so we can delve into the problem more and see if we can get to the bottom of it.
Okay, so this child is seeing their primary and they're having hospitalizations or they're having frequent infections. Is this the progression of care that they should be, okay, this is out of the realm of just a primary care maintenance, and this is, let's go to the specialist?
Yeah, we absolutely have guidelines that encourage, you know, referral to the specialist, you know, early on, even when we are seeing, you know, just a few instances of wheezing episodes, for instance. And I think it depends on the comfort of the primary care provider too, in terms of whether to initiate even a first line therapy to begin with before then referring over to pulmonary. I see that it's variable here in Alaska, at least, and I think even in the lower 48 too. There's different comfort levels depending on different providers, but I think for sure, if there is higher frequency of symptoms like that and concern for something whereby, you know, these patients are being seen multiple times by their primary care provider for a breathing problem throughout the year, that should be investigated a little bit more. And again, I always encourage, you know, again, I'd be glad to see anybody. I never frown upon any kind of referral. I think every referral is important to acknowledge. And again, listen to the person and the family about their concerns and hopefully get to the bottom of what's going on.
When it comes to asthma care, here we have allergy, asthma, immunology. We have, and I know there are many asthma clinics, and then there's pulmonology, and probably there's combinations. Like I think in some of the allergy clinics, they also have pulmonologists, and some do not. Mm-hmm. So how do we decide, or how does the primary decide which track to go down?
Yeah, there's a huge overlap when it comes to allergy and asthma, 100%. We know that the vast majority of asthmatics, their symptoms are triggered by an allergic type of nature, meaning something environmental, whether it's something outside, trees, some type of flower, or indoors, you know, pets, dust, things of that nature that we know can definitely cause these problems to occur for people. So I think that's what can sometimes be confusing in terms of who do we refer to. But we essentially are going down the same path in terms of workup. You know, I think we look at it a bit differently, my allergy colleagues and myself, but ultimately the treatment ends up being very similar. So I don't have any issues with an allergist, you know, seeing an asthmatic patient. Again, in my training and from my experience, you know, pulmonary was always the go-to, you know, for asthma evaluation and treatment. However, with that being said, I refer a decent number of patients to allergy and immunology because, again, if we're looking to figure out some underlying triggers and, you know, maybe anything out there that we can avoid, you know, allergy is super, super helpful with that. So I think it depends on the situation, again, but both specialties are definitely well equipped to treat the condition.
Oh, I appreciate that perspective. Mm-hmm. We have an email that perhaps you can address. This is from Carol, who says, thank you for the show today. And she knows you're talking about pediatric asthma, but she's wondering if you could speak briefly on the onset of asthma as adults. And she mentions that she's found that frequently it's due to infected sinuses. And when you've treated the sinusitis, then the asthma symptoms have resolved. Can you speak to this?
Sure. Well, again, I always question when somebody has asthma. You know, I want to know what has been done, what workup has been done, because I think it could sometimes be a very, what I would call, lazy diagnosis. You know, we may be misdiagnosing something as asthma. So what I like to always consider is, what are the main symptoms that are occurring? And in this instance, from what is being described, it seems to be more of a sinus or upper airway related issue there. And certainly, if we don't have that situation under control, that kind of a picture can definitely lead to increased cough, wheezing, and asthma-like symptoms. But again, we haven't addressed the root cause of the problem, which could be chronic sinusitis or something anatomical in that area that, you know, needs to be addressed by an ear, nose, and throat specialist. So what I would encourage in that situation is, if it already has not happened, a very thorough ENT evaluation, imaging if it has not already occurred, and, you know, again, potentially some aggressive treatment to address the sinus related symptoms to see if the breathing then resolves, because I do question that. And again, one of the things we can help to tease out whether we have both things on board would be lung function testing. I mean, that's something I do regularly for anybody above the age of 5 years. You know, they're able to typically give us a sense of what their lung function looks like, and we can trend that over time. We can give an albuterol treatment in clinic and then repeat the testing and see if there's any reversibility of their lung function, meaning do the numbers improve, which would suggest an asthma kind of diagnosis. But again, I would definitely not be ignoring those upper airway symptoms with a sinus.
So in this woman, is it possible that it wasn't asthma and that it was always upper airway?
Absolutely. I think, again, I've seen even in the pediatric patients, you know, kids with enlarged tonsils or adenoids that, again, have been causing a lot of their asthma-like symptoms, and they're carrying this asthma diagnosis, but then, you know, they have their upper airway problems optimized, again, either removal of, you know, the obstruction like enlarged adenoids or tonsils, or, you know, they start or initiate a more aggressive sinus regimen, meaning, you know, using certain medications, nasal rinses, things of that nature, avoiding certain triggers that could be causing things like allergies, and the symptoms go away. And that to me is not asthma. You know, if the person is not having persistent coughing, wheezing that's requiring inhaled therapies and their lung function's normal, that to me is not an asthma related problem.
We don't have much time before the break, but I do want to take a caller. We have Stu from Eagle River. Stu, welcome to line one.
Thanks, Doc Jillian. Hey, is there a condition called frost lung? I have to ski sometimes, 18 below. It's a do or die, Ooh. You know, 10 miles. And I have asthma conditions off and off, and have to sit in a lazy boy to sleep because I have to elevate my chest. And with the wood stoves, we have the new wood stoves that burn really efficiently, and the old ones. And I know you have to open the damper for 10 seconds at least before you open that door to throw the wood in, or you're going to breathe a pack of cigarette smoke in. A future show, we might want to talk about wood stoves and asthma. That would be really interesting. But yeah, frost lung. I always tell people I have frost lung, but, you know, maybe they're not. Could you talk about that? Thanks, guys. I got
to
go.
Thank you. Thanks for the question. What do you have to say to that?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting term. I think it's very appropriate for Alaska. I mean, I've never heard of anyone describe it as frost lung, but certainly we know cold air is a trigger for a lot of people, especially with underlying asthma. And what I would say there is, you know, I don't know what kind of evaluation has been done, but, you know, to really get to, you know, the underlying etiology or reason behind those symptoms. Again, we have different ways to go about that in our pulmonary function lab. We can do some form of exercise testing. We can administer a medication in the pulmonary function lab that can induce asthma-like symptoms. So essentially cause your airway to get smaller. And then we give you albuterol and try to reverse it. So really trying to simulate what you're experiencing in the cold weather. I do wonder too, you know, if you mention, you know, an asthma diagnosis already, if you've tried using albuterol or some type of a bronchodilator prior to being exposed to those conditions. You know, what I'm recommending to, you know, any of the people that I see who have similar symptoms is absolutely when you know you're going to be out in the cold weather and this triggers you, you use the albuterol, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes before. And, you know, it typically has a duration of a good 3 to 4 hours that can allow your airway to stay open and hopefully avoid this frost lung kind of a situation. Now, you know, when we're breathing through our nose, our nose is helping to humidify and warm the air. So, you know, that could be another issue too. You know, if you're more of a mouth breather, of course, then you're bypassing that whole humidification system. But I'll tell you what, in Alaska here, when you're getting that cold, I don't think even the nose humidification system is going to be enough when it's, you know, negative 20, negative 30 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yes. Oh, it hurts to breathe at negative 5. I have to cover my face.
Oh, it's horrendous. I know.
Well, are you thinking with Stu that this could be, that it's possible that a person can have an underlying asthma?
Absolutely.
That's just being triggered by the cold. And maybe perhaps it was mild all of this time.
100%. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the biggest things that I try to delve into when I see somebody. What is causing your problems? You know, a lot of times we know it's, you know, viruses or infection, but there tend to be other things as well. You know, when a person's at their baseline, you know, what are they being exposed to that causes the symptoms that they're telling me about? And a lot of times we hear that it is the cold weather. What we know in general is that the cold, for a lot of people, you know, with no other triggers, tends to cause what we call bronchoconstriction. It's making the airway smaller. So it could lead to those kinds of symptoms like shortness of breath, wheezing, you know, you're not able to continue the activity that you're trying to keep up with. You know, this is definitely something that is quite common, but treatable, you know, if we have a short-acting albuterol and something that we are good about using prior to activity.
Very good information. Thank you so much. We're going to get more into this after we take a quick break, and we'll talk more about asthma in general and childhood asthma. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. We'll continue our discussion after the break.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news on Alaska News Nightly or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. I'm joined by Dr. Jared Weinstock, a pediatric pulmonologist and medical director with Providence Medical Group. Today, we're talking about pediatric lung conditions with a particular focus on asthma and how families can navigate care when breathing problems can persist. So, Dr. Weinstock, let's focus our attention on asthma and tell us about some of the common symptoms. How is asthma actually diagnosed? And is there an age where it's more diagnosed than at other times?
Sure. So I think it depends on the age range, and I think we can spend some time talking about the differences there. So I like to group it as, you know, more of the toddler kind of a presentation versus, again, the school age teenager, young adult kind of a presentation. So, you know, there was an interesting study performed years ago out of Tucson, Arizona. It was a big study looking at infants, you know, around the age of 3 or so that continue to have frequent wheezing episodes. So again, wheezing is a symptom that is a result of your airway constricting or getting smaller for some reason. Something is triggering that to happen. Most commonly, again, in the little kids, we see that as being an illness. So like RSV or the flu or pneumonia, something like that, that is causing an increase in the airway inflammation and causing that airway to get smaller. So out of the study that was done in Tucson, Arizona, because again, the young kids, we can't do lung function testing in terms of like spirometry. They're just not going to be able to cooperate and follow directions. Mm-hmm. So we really have to go by the symptoms. And from what the study showed, some of the red flags in the history, which is super important. So at every visit, when I'm seeing somebody for the first time, one of the three major red flags that were pointed out from this large study are a mom with a history of asthma. If I hear a mom that says, yeah, you know what, I had childhood asthma or I have asthma presently, that to me is a huge red flag, because genetics, we know, especially in the maternal immediate family, is huge. So that's a major red flag. Atopic dermatitis or eczema, huge, because we see that tied together with this whole what we call atopic or allergic kind of a picture. So if I see a child, or actually anybody really, who has really significant eczema, you know, I do wonder, especially if they're coming to see me with their breathing, you know, this is pointing more towards the direction of an asthma-like diagnosis, okay? Or asthma in general. And then finally, I would say the third one is some type of allergy. We know that the patient, you know, maybe we do some testing, blood work or skin testing with the allergists, and we see that the person has these triggers to, here for Alaska, in Alaska, for instance, birch or foods or pets, you know, things of that nature. That's another red flag as well. And then secondarily, some of the more minor red flags would be, again, you know, people that are responding well to bronchodilators. You know, maybe they've had significant improvement with systemic steroids in the past. You know, these kinds of things. But those three major red flags that I pointed out, with the maternal family history of asthma, eczema, and some type of allergy, definitely point in the direction. So history taking is super important. And what I say is, you know, in the smaller kids, it's very hard to 100% confirm asthma a lot of times. And what I'll typically do is, you know, try a very basic inhaled corticosteroid, a very safe therapy to use that can help drive down that inflammation that they've built up for whatever reason from, again, a viral illness or an environmental trigger. And we see if they have benefit there. And we certainly know that they should likely respond if I'm seeing them in the hospital and they're getting better with, you know, systemic steroids like prednisolone or dexamethasone. You know, those are huge things that point in the direction of, okay, we're dealing with some type of increased inflammation in the airway. Compared to, again, you know, kids 5 and above who, if the symptoms, again, symptom and history taking is super, super important, but now we can objectively do some testing to look and see if it's correlating with their symptoms. So again, right in my office, everybody knows you're going to come and see me. And after we talk and I take a listen to you, you know, we're going to do lung function testing. Super important initially to get a good baseline and then also to trend at every visit. We see, okay, how are you responding to treatment if I had to put you on anything? And do we need to do anything else to better optimize that treatment? So lung, I love the lung function because it's, the lung function testing, because it's just such an easy way and simple. It's not time consuming whatsoever to look into this, you know, to a larger extent. And then downstairs in the at Providence where I'm at, we have a larger functioning, you know, pulmonary testing lab that we can even do a number of other different tests, like I was talking about earlier with, you know, what we call a methacholine or mannitol challenge test, where we can really try to induce asthma symptoms and then give the albuterol and see if they have improvement. Or we can put somebody on a treadmill and get them going, wow, get their heart rate up and see if their lung function's going down. So is it more like an exercise-induced asthma kind of a situation there? So there's a number of different ways, again, that it could present. But with the older patients, we definitely have more ways to look into that. And again, I think it's just something, even if it's mild symptoms, you don't want to ignore that. Going back to what we talked about earlier, you know, if we're dealing with underlying airway inflammation that is not getting better and not being treated, this can go on down the road. Even if the person is asymptomatic for a decent amount of time, but their lung function's abnormal, this could go down the road in years to become like a COPD kind of a picture. And now it's irreversible. We have chronic lung damage and we cannot fix it. So that's why I make such a big deal, especially in the pediatric population and everyone that I see in my office, to try to be adherent to the treatment as possible. I know we all have busy lives and, you know, we are very involved with after school activities and, you know, education, all of that kind of stuff. But we need to make sure our breathing is under control too, so we can enjoy all of that and not face any long-term repercussions down the road. So I make a big, big deal out of that. But again, the biggest reasons that I would be super concerned would certainly be, again, when I hear somebody's in and out of the hospital, the emergency department, you know, again, on the courses of systemic steroids very frequently, something's not right there. And we're not doing a good job treating the underlying condition if I'm hearing that. And it's more common than you think here, unfortunately. And not just here in Alaska, you know, it's everywhere where we see just this condition, I think, you know, being undertreated or just not compliant with what's being recommended.
What are the types of asthma? You've mentioned the allergic contributor. You've also mentioned exercise-induced. Are there other triggers for asthma or other types of asthma?
So over the last couple years, we are entering this era of asthma treatment that is more individualized, we're saying. So we have ways to not only get a sense of lung function, but also with some lab testing, we call certain tests that I order biomarkers. So, you know, we have certain ways to phenotype or look at what type of asthma we're dealing with in the overall asthma population. Now, the most common type of asthma that I mentioned earlier is more of this allergic asthma, or, you know, if you do your own research, it'll sometimes be called, or it is called, type 2 asthma. Okay, so type 2 refers to somebody who does have some underlying allergic trigger. You know, again, when we do these biomarker tests, they may have elevated eosinophils, which are a type of white blood cell that we would detect on a complete blood cell count, or a CBC, that when they are elevated, we think, okay, there's something allergic going on here. This is more of a type 2 asthma situation. And the people with type 2 asthma, or this allergic picture, make up about, I would say, 85 to 90% of asthma. It's a huge bulk of the asthma population. And we have a lot of good treatments available, fortunately. You know, we have the inhaled treatments and various different kinds of combinations of those. And then over the last few years, we even have this class of medications known as biologic therapies. Now, they're injectable, you know, they're subcutaneous, but they do a tremendous job at treating a lot of our more moderate, persistent, or certainly the severe persistent asthmatics who have this type 2 picture.
Kids and injections.
Ooh, correct. Well, yeah. So it's not a fun conversation. You know, I think everyone has anxiety around hearing an injectable therapy. But if we're maxed out on inhaled therapies and, you know, the person fits this picture whereby, you know, look, yeah, you are, you know, a really allergic person and on all of these steroids all the time, you know, we have to do something about this. We have to keep you out of the hospital, have to prevent your lung function from deteriorating. On the flip side of type 2 is what we call non-type 2, or sometimes referred to as type 1. These are, you know, you do a workup and get good history taking, and these are non-allergic asthmatics. Nothing is in the history that seems to trigger them, aside from maybe respiratory illnesses, of course, but they are usually very difficult to treat. And we're very limited in options right now, like the biologic therapies for the non-type 2 asthmatics. There's a lot of good research right now, a lot of good candidates in the pipeline, you know, looking at ways to better treat these patients, but they tend to be more dependent on steroids like, you know, prednisone or dexamethasone, which again are the classes of medications
so
we try to avoid.
Steroids.
Correct. Oh, yes. Wow. In my experience, I've had people with non, you know, type 2 asthma, or this type 1, you can call it, that have needed, we've been unable to wean them off prednisone or prednisolone. So they're on low dose steroids as maintenance, which, I mean, you know, I mean, they come with devastating side effects, especially at certainly the higher doses. So there's a huge unmet need in that type of asthma. And hopefully in the next few years, we see some good candidates come to the surface here to treat them.
Well, before we go to our next caller, I want you to talk about inhaled steroids. And I know when you're thinking about, do I put my child on steroids? You hear steroids and you're thinking about all of the risks or weight gain in your child or prolonged use of steroids. So can you talk about what the risks are and how they're different from, how they may be different from systemic steroids?
Sure. So yes, I think the misconception with the inhaled steroids comes because of the whole connotation that we know is associated with systemic steroids. So when I say systemic steroids, I'm talking about, again, the common ones that we hear that are prescribed are, you know, prednisolone in the younger population, prednisone or dexamethasone. And again, they could negatively affect pretty much every organ in the body negatively, okay? So we know, yes, weight gain, mood changes, bone problems, increased risk for infection. You know, certainly in short bursts, you know, 3 to 5 days of steroids here and there, you know, typically we need them. I mean, you know, the benefits are going to outweigh the risk at that point acutely. But long-term, that is not normal to continue to require these. And that's where the inhaled steroids come into play. So the inhaled steroid class has gone through extremely rigorous testing. They are extremely safe. I am never using them at super, super high doses. There was a study done way back when that looked at super high doses of the inhaled steroid, and there was some absorption into the bloodstream that I think everyone sort of, you know, raised concern about because there was this 1 or 2 centimeter decrease in growth velocity, which is not much to begin with. But again, those were at super, super high doses of the inhaled steroids. The ones that I typically am prescribing, you know, low dose or medium dose, we're not going to see that systemic absorption. These are inhaled. They're usually delivered, you know, if a regular type of an inhaler, it's given with a spacer, it's called, to help deliver it directly to the airway. Or if it's a dry powdered inhaler, you know, we use it correctly and you know, it's inhaled directly into the lungs without any major absorption into the bloodstream. So we avoid all of those nasty side effects that we typically see with systemic steroids. So I want to make that clear. The inhaled corticosteroids are super, super safe. I use them in super young children, even in the NICU setting, and they have tremendous benefits there in terms of decreasing that airway inflammation and leading to great outcomes long term.
Okay, I think that is certainly reassuring for families and caregivers. We do have to take another break, but before we do, we have a caller that I would like to welcome, Anita from Ketchikan. Welcome to Line 1. Anita, are you there with us? Nope. Okay, we will, if you call us back or retry us, we can hear you. We'd love to welcome you after the break, okay? Let's step away briefly for another short break. When we return, we'll continue to discuss how families can navigate ongoing asthma care. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
Welcome back to Line 1. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. I'm joined by Dr. Jared Weinstock, a board-certified pediatric pulmonologist and medical director of pediatric subspecialties at Providence Alaska Medical Center. He now cares for children across the state with complex breathing and lung conditions. In this final segment, we will focus on how ongoing asthma care is managed and when it may be time to involve a specialist. Okay, I think we may have our caller back. Let's see if we can hear you. Anita, are you there from Ketchikan?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, welcome.
Hi, how's it going?
Oh, we're great. We're having a wonderful conversation, and I'm learning a lot for sure. What can we answer for you?
Well, I just wanted to just throw this kind of out into the air. As far as when I was a little girl, I did have a little bit of exercise-induced asthma that kind of went away later in life. But when I was a kid, I'd always be outside, and I would look up in the air, and I'd see the planes flying, and every once in a while, I would see what I used to call a zipper. And when I was a kid, I would say God would open up the sky with those zippers when a plane would fly by. Now, I'm a lot older than I was when I was a kid, and I look up into the sky, and almost every single one of those planes has a zipper coming back on the end of it. Could be something, could not be something, but it's definitely something to consider.
Is the zip, are you talking about the emissions from the plane, is that a zipper? Like the smoke?
Well, that yeah.
Okay.
The trail behind the plane.
I see.
I call it a zipper. You can call it something else that everybody calls a conspiracy, but I call it a zipper.
Okay, that brings up some interesting questions. Thank you for calling us. I guess I was actually thinking about, you know, radiation and if there's issues with lungs as you're in the plane. So I didn't even think about the emissions from the planes going overhead, especially if somebody lives in a high airplane flying zone. I don't know what they call that. But I don't know. Do you come across this? Do you know anything about this?
Well, what I would say is, Anita, I think what you're referring to is potentially some type of an irritant in the atmosphere. And we know, so there's a big difference between earlier, like I was talking about some of these triggers, and we say, you know, the triggers can really be broken down to something like irritants. So again, things like the wood-burning stoves or these volatile compounds, you know, in the environment that could be, you know, a result of what you're seeing, you know, with the airplane emissions versus, again, you know, a classic allergy, right? So, you know, something like a dog or cat allergy, you know, completely different types of triggers there. So absolutely. I mean, irritants like that can certainly affect people who have underlying asthma or underlying airway inflammation. It could absolutely aggravate that 100%. And we see that happening, you know, I think at, you know, probably higher rates than we think, but it is absolutely something to consider. I think everyone's different. You know, I think for an irritant, it could really affect any of us. Sort of when you think about last year with all of the alarm regarding the volcano that was supposed to erupt, right? That could affect any of us because those kinds of emissions are irritants, okay? But certainly for somebody who has underlying, lung issues at baseline, it could really, really exacerbate those symptoms to a larger degree.
That makes a lot of sense. Absolutely. And now it's making me think about how some children, their asthma symptoms improve or resolve over the years as they grow, while others persist. And why is there this mismatch?
Well, I think, again, it really goes back to how were they treated? What was the severity of their symptoms back then? I see that too, where, over even sometimes a couple months or a couple years, these symptoms go away. Maybe it was just some mild underlying airway inflammation. They got hit hard with something. Maybe they really don't have any underlying allergy triggers, but we took care of the airway inflammation with something like the inhaled treatments, like the inhaled corticosteroid or some of these other combination inhalers. And, they're doing really well. We follow up. We even do, lung function testing and reevaluations months after coming off medication, and things are really stable. So it definitely can happen, where people do grow out of this. But I worry about those more so with the moderate severe symptoms early on. And again, all of those other red flags we talked about earlier, especially family history, if those are in line, sometimes we end up dealing with this a bit longer than we would like to.
Can you tell us briefly about exercise-induced asthma and what is the cause there? Is there a cause that's been identified?
Well, exercise-induced asthma is, again, I think a pretty common thing out there for a lot of people who, again, even at baseline don't have any problems. Even when they get sick, they're not really experiencing any major issues. It's primarily just with activity. Physiologically, what we know is that with exercise, it can constrict the airway. It can make any of our airways a bit smaller. And for some people, again, could be your genetic makeup or any other underlying inflammation there, it could make those kinds of symptoms or that constriction of the airway more dramatic. And I see that happening with a decent number. I would say teenagers coming in, athletes who don't have any problems until they're doing activity. And we do the investigation, including getting you on a treadmill and, getting your heart rate up and again, replicating what is happening when you're exercising. And we see that lung function drop, and then it comes right back up with albuterol. So that confirms the diagnosis right there. And then from then on, my biggest recommendation is just your couple puffs of albuterol, 15, 20 minutes before activity, and that usually should be able to take care of it. So again, we have ways to evaluate that to a larger extent, both in our larger pulmonary function lab, but even in the clinic. If we do the lung function testing and the numbers are a little bit decreased even at baseline, but they're asymptomatic, that could also give us a lot of answers. Maybe you didn't realize you also have, this asthma, situation at baseline and not just with activity. And so, again, you're not as optimized as you really think, and we need to do something else about that. So that's where I think the evaluation is critical, and looking at, the big picture to try to tease out really, really what is going on here.
Do all of the patients with the exercise-induced asthma need inhaled steroids, or are some of them only managed with albuterol?
Yeah, some of them are only managed with as-needed albuterol. So if I have somebody coming into the clinic, again, history-wise, asymptomatic at baseline, lung function beautiful at baseline with no problems, and then we do the exercise testing and we see the result of exercise being the only major problem that's leading to their downtrending function, yeah, we can just do a short-acting albuterol as needed before activity.
Can you talk us through the stepwise progression in treatment? So we have the bronchodilator to open up those airways, the albuterol, and then we have inhaled steroids. And then what is the next step?
Yeah. So we have a lot of good guidelines out there and a lot of international societies that help guide us as pulmonologists, allergists, and properly treating people, even primary care physicians. There are some basic asthma guidelines out there. So typically, we classify patients with asthma based on their symptoms. So, how severe are they? Are they happening every day? Are they only happening once a week or once a month? Okay. That can help us decide, are you an intermittent asthmatic, meaning do you just need as needed inhalers? Or again, are you having more frequent symptoms and then even again, some abnormal lung function that puts you into this either mild persistent, moderate persistent, or severe persistent category? That's how we break it down. And then based on that evaluation, now we can figure out how to best optimize your treatment. So for a mild persistent asthmatic, somebody who's maybe, having symptoms, I don't know, a few times a week, but nothing major. You know, I think an inhaled corticosteroid is something very simple that we can start with, even low dose, and, you know, see the person back in a few weeks and see if things are better. If things are continuing to progress, or maybe, you know, based on my evaluation, you know, you have more of a moderate persistent asthma diagnosis, you may need a combination inhaler. And what that means is you'll be put on something like an inhaled corticosteroid combined with a long-acting bronchodilator. So something like your short-acting albuterol, but it's acting longer. It has like a 12-hour or 24-hour duration. So they're used either once a day or twice a day. And again, if that's not working, we have some therapies out there that are considered triple therapies. So two long-acting forms of bronchodilators in them, plus that inhaled corticosteroid, to see if we can really, really try our best to keep just the inhaled therapies on board. Unfortunately, like I referred to earlier, if that's not cutting it, or if we really have especially a lot of other comorbidities, meaning let's say you have pretty severe asthma and you also have bad allergies and eczema and chronic rhinosinusitis, for instance, then we can turn to the biologic therapies that are the subcutaneous, meaning they're being injected under the skin, typically in the stomach area or wherever we have some fatty tissue, on average, you know, every 2 weeks or every month. And these can work wonders for people who, again, are not as well controlled on the inhaled therapy. So that's typically the progression. And then, you know, once we have somebody stabilized, we follow up, you know, every, you know, 3 to 4 months or so, and certainly encourage families and people and patients to reach out to us if there are any problems in the meantime.
Are these biologic treatments, are they lifelong?
So we don't have any guidance on how long to continue the biologic therapies. I spoke to an allergist a couple years ago who said it best, we should continue them until we don't need them anymore. Meaning, I think there's a lot of, we're unclear on just how long. In my experience, I think we need to do them for at least a year. I think at the 1 to 2 year mark, I think it's reasonable if, especially the person or the families are like, okay, we're sick of doing this. We've been doing great. Can we try to come off of it? Sure, but let's give it a shot. I mean, worst case, we have to restart it. So yeah, not too much guidance there, but I think hopefully in the near future, we will have something to help, you know, guide us a bit better there.
Is there a cure for asthma?
Unfortunately, no. There's nothing that's like a one-time fix here. You know, this is something, asthma is a condition that, again, is describing, it's almost like a syndrome. It's describing, again, that smaller type of an airway that constricts when you're triggered by something. You have increased mucus, you have increased inflammation associated usually with wheezing and coughing. And I wouldn't say there's one therapy that can cure it. We could try to remodel those lungs back to normal with all of these therapies I'm talking about. And the hope then is that, you know, if the airway can get remodeled, hopefully it just stays that way even once we try to wean off therapy. So maybe you can look at that as a cure, but I wouldn't necessarily call any of the therapies, none of them are known to be curative therapies, per se.
So yeah, this is a long-term chronic condition that you're managing. You're trying to remove triggers or reduce triggers so there are less symptoms that they have. Can you tell us about some of the maybe lesser known symptoms? Because I think when we think about asthma, we're thinking about wheezing mostly, and then maybe cough. So what are some of the other ways that it could present?
Yeah, I would say some of the major red flags to me, waking up at nighttime coughing. You know, some people don't think that that's a problem, or maybe they're not tuned into those symptoms. You know, maybe other family members haven't noticed because they're not in the same area of the house that the person's sleeping. So nighttime coughing is a huge red flag. We know that this is not normal. Aside from wheezing, certainly coughing, you know, with activity, or what I also see too, you know, when we get sick with a virus, we shouldn't be sick, you know, typically longer than a week maybe. You know, so when I hear somebody coming in telling me, yeah, my symptoms are continuing for a couple weeks, it takes me forever to get over, you know, even a common cold, that's not normal either. So being tuned into that, we talked about issues with physical activity, you know, having increased coughing with physical activity, not being able to keep up with your peers despite, you know, being in having good conditioning and all of that kind of stuff. So I think those are things to absolutely consider, because yes, it's not always just the wheezing. It could be, you know, things like the nighttime coughing that can certainly raise alarm for something going on.
Right. And it's also something that the child they're not going to tell you because they're going to be sleeping through it. So it's something you'd have to hear and then bring that up.
Correct.
Are there any things that they may be experiencing that They may not take to their provider because they may not think that it's worthy of mentioning.
Well, I think that's, you know, a lot of times, yeah, sometimes, you know, families don't know what to bring up, or or the person doesn't know that this is something they should be telling me. And then as I'm, you know, of course, I'm opening it up initially and listening to the person. But then I have my pointed questions like this. You know, if I didn't hear them mention anything about the nighttime cough, I'll certainly ask, hey, do you ever wake up at nighttime coughing, or do you hear so-and-so coughing at night? Or what happens when you are at gym, at school, or running around? Are you able to keep up with people? You know, things like that can really help them think and be like, oh, yeah, I didn't think about that. Or how long does it take you to get over a cold? Oh, gosh, sometimes it could take me 2-3 weeks. But, right. You know, initially they had not brought that up. So, again, sometimes you do have to, you know, try to encourage those kinds of things by asking certain questions.
Thank you so much. Before we end, let me just give you a moment to share any important takeaways that you think would be helpful for families or providers.
Yeah. I think in general, I think the biggest thing for me is to not be afraid to, you know, ask for, again, more evaluation. If you feel like something is going on, I don't think any, you know, primary care provider should have any reluctance to sending a referral to a pulmonologist or any specialist, to be honest. So you need to advocate for yourself. And if something doesn't feel right, voice your opinion, and we're here for you. That's our job here. And I'm certainly grateful to be here in Alaska.
Thank you so much, Dr. Weinstock. Thank you for being with us. Thank you to our audio engineer, Crystal Hyde, and our producer, Tobin Shelby. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Thank you.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants, and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.